through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Hour number two of Tom, Jake, and Stacy. We are thrilled to be joined in studio, I believe, by one Brock Heward. Brock, how are you today?
Yo, it feels good in the studio. Man, this feels just right. I had to come in here and get a bunch of stuff taped for our podcast, our Above and Beyond podcast with Compassion. So had a bunch of things to do, got a chance to come in here, and it is. I think this is the seat that Stacy sits cross-legged in. I think that's the seat that I'm sitting in right now. Yeah. How are you guys doing today?
Yeah, you always give me a hard time for that.
Yeah, well, it's because you've got the flexibility to do so. If I tried to do that, I wouldn't get out of the chair.
I'm a very small
Brock, man. I want to talk about one of your favorite guys. I want to talk about Peyton Manning. And I want to go back to 2012 because I remember we had this debate almost every day for as long as it was a rumor that Pete Carroll was interested in bringing Peyton Manning here. Curtis, can you roll cut number two? This is Peter King. Talking about why the Peyton Manning to the Seahawks thing didn't work.
One of his really good friends was a guy named Brandon Stokely. He was a wide receiver, played with Peyton in Indianapolis for a while, and then he played in Denver. And so Brandon Stokely was living in Denver at the time, and basically Manning stayed with Stokely when he had visited the Broncos on this trip. And when he visited the Broncos on this trip, the Seattle Seahawks and Pete Carroll flew to the airport right near the Broncos facility, even though Manning said he really didn't want them to do that. And Manning didn't go meet Pete Carroll. You know, he ended up, Pete Carroll flew to Denver chasing Peyton Manning, and Manning never met with him. He got back on the plane and just flew back to Seattle.
Okay, Brock. So knowing how much interest that Pete Carroll had in Peyton Manning, right? This is before Russell Wilson, really before we knew much about him. I'm sure Schneider and Carroll had been scouting him, but before we really knew anything about him, Pete really wanted him, so much so that he flew down to Denver uninvited by Peyton Manning, right? And was like, hey, we're going to wait here anyway. My question is this. If Pete was so desperate to get Peyton Manning, do you think he would have been willing to change his philosophy to do more what Peyton Manning would have been wanted to do, as opposed to the way it is now, where you know they're not designing the offense around Russell Wilson for whatever reason? Do you think that he would have budged for Peyton Manning?
Yeah, I think he probably would have, you know, trusted a guy that was one of the best in the game to do that and to manage the game and to manage when to run and pass. You see, everybody thinks that Peyton, and even in my time in Indy, before I got there, my perception was, oh, they're just pass happy. They're just going to throw it all the time, and this is going to be great, and I'm going to go live in the shotgun and throw it 50 times a game. And that wasn't the essence of what they did in Indy. I mean, they were a 12 personnel team, one back, two tight ends. That he every play would check run or pass based on the numbers, based on the box count, you know. And Edgerrin James was a really good running back. In fact, became a Hall of Fame running back because of that system and his ability to run the ball in the system and play action in that system. Right? I mean, that is where he cut his teeth, and ultimately leaning on a run game and a defense won him a title in Indy, and then later in his career, as his skill set deteriorated, it won him a second title. So I don't think it would have been, Tom, a wholesale, oh my gosh, we're going to throw it 40 times a game. It would have been great. You fit exactly what I want to do. You know how to manage a game. You know how to play it. You know how to protect the ball. You learned how to protect the ball under Tony Dungy, a defensive coach. And, you know, we want you to come here and employ that same run, play action, and fit in with our elite defense. And, Tom, I remember that so vividly. I cannot believe that was 8 years ago. I remember writing a letter. Do you remember? You were producing our show, I think, then. Do you remember I wrote a letter to Peyton, a public letter? It was like the first thing I did, I think, in radio that actually hit on a national level. I remember doing SportsCenter with Trey Wingo, like doing a segment on ESPN where he's like, well, you seem to have written this letter and it's taken off. And he was like poking all these holes in it. But I remember writing that. It was like one of my first big, wow, aha moments that radio and writing can become a little bit viral, and had a blast with that. And then I remember even more so sitting with John Schneider after that season and him being really upset with me because I was pushing the envelope about, hey, quarterback, and can a quarterback ever be too big? And can he ever have too big a name to still fit in this system? And he was just giving me the stink eye of stink eye before they went out there and did try to convince Peyton. So, yeah, can't believe it's been 8 years.
You know, Jake was trying to put together the timeline, too, of, like, when Matt Flynn got signed, and I interrupted him immediately. I was like, you know what?
Yep.
He got signed the day that Brock and I were sitting
Saint
in a bar
Patrick's.
In Dublin.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
March 2012, there it was. I remember that was the first show I ever did.
Yep.
Matt Flynn gets signed.
Because poor Salky and Heather, Heather broke her leg in Italy, and Salky had to stick around. Never made it to Ireland, Tom. So that's when your star was launched, baby.
The other question I wanted to ask you has to do with Patrick Mahomes, John Schneider's interest or his passing interest in him, and also this rumored trade to the Browns for the number one pick of Russell Wilson. Do you think it's possible that a GM can go too far in exploring other options at the expense of breaking trust with his players?
Mm. That's a good question and a fair question. And do I think it can go too far? I think it can if there's not a level of respect, transparency, and honesty, right? If you're doing stuff to backstab, you know, some of the Jerry Krause stuff we just watched in this 10-piece documentary where it was about you and your ego and your organization, and, you know, you really want to try to make that known, and you use some back channels to do that. I don't think that's the way this group operates. I do think with Russell, it's been a journey over 8 years because I think his representation, Tom, in Mark Rogers goes about doing his job differently than most football agents do. And I think much of this conversation, be it in 18 or when his first contract was done, I think there was a lot of spinning. There was a lot of leveraging. There was a lot of using the public and the media. You know, that's kind of a baseball agent's MO. And so I think that's where a lot of this talk and conversations come from. I think if you're disingenuous, I think if you're dishonest and you're deceitful and you stab people in the back in management, yeah, I think you can go too far. I don't think that's the card, though, that's been played here over the last 8 years.
Brock, we were looking just in the last segment about foundational pieces for the Seahawks and how they're currently building their team, how they're going about it. And you really look at it, and there's not a whole lot that you grasp onto and say, man, this is a really strong foundation. I've called them keystones. Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, that's how they've constructed their roster, and they're building everything around it. Because they have those two guys identified, are they having to now, do you accept the idea that they're having to take the approach with constant, for lack of a better word, retread guys that are on 1-2 year deals? Or is this a big miss for this organization over the last 4 or 5 years that they haven't been able to establish a strong foundation you know, through the draft and things of that nature?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jake. I think you'll enjoy. We had Daniel Jeremiah on our podcast that we taped today. So I think that comes out tonight with Salk and I. And I think you're going to enjoy some of the conversation that we had with him around that. Because Salk asked him point blank, like, and I don't know, did you guys talk with Salk about this a half hour ago or 45 minutes ago already?
No.
But, no, we haven't.
Yeah, so Salk was asked him kind of point blank, hey, you know, what is a reasonable return on a draft? You know, what's a good draft? You know, because we've spent a lot of time, to your point, kind of talking about that and analyzing it. And in his view, he said, if you find three starters per draft and a blue chipper, right, someone that like a Russell, like a Richard, like a Cam, like a Earl, like they found a bunch of blue chippers early, and at least one blue chipper per draft with three starters, you've done your job. You're going to be able to sustain some success, some long-term sustained success. And, you know, I think they've found a bunch of starters in this draft over the years. But as far as true blue chippers, you put Frank Clark there? You probably do, right? I mean, his contract in Kansas City speaks to that. Tyler Lockett's become a Pro Bowl player, and he gets an extension here. You know, DK had a really promising rookie year. It looks like he could be on that trajectory. But, no, I think that that is a fair question and a fair debate. And in particular, the last time I was on with you guys, arguing about this last draft and how much was it projection and how many starters and impact players are you going to find? So I would challenge, though, Jake, I would challenge and say the one thing you have had here, which is an enormous advantage over most of this league, is you have had stability. You have had Pete, and you have had John, and you have had Russ, and you have the most important cornerstones, and you haven't been stupid enough to let John Schneider go to Green Bay, right? Pete Carroll has stuck it out here and has wanted to be here, and you've been able to sustain that. Your quarterback, through two, you know, at times contentious contract negotiations, is here. And when those staples are here, you give your chance to team build in ways that that's the envy of most people in this league, where there's usually constant turnover.
Do you think there's ever been a constant theme or pattern with some of their draft missteps?
Yeah, I heard some sound of Pete Carroll this morning on the Ringer podcast that he was on, talking about sometimes he's too hopeful. I think sometimes he gets captivated by what a guy can do. And he said this, is his words, not mine. It's just, yeah, man, when I see something that I love that someone can do, I don't need to see a lot of the rest of the tape, right? I don't need to see what they can't do. That focus of, man, I can take this CJ Procise's speed. I can take this Amaro Darboh's, you know, athleticism. I can take this and I can make that player great. I do think at times when they have missed Stacy, that's been it. It's just like focus on, oh, man, we can take that one gift and make it great and not realize, yeah, but there's the other part of it, like, it's not just the highlight tape. You can learn a lot from the low light tape as well of what they can't do and how much of that are you going to be able to really change. So that would probably be my critique or criticism. And I think even Pete kind of admitted that, yeah, maybe at times he's a little too positive and uber hopeful that he can get the most out of and the most return out of certainly some risky picks over the years.
Do you think they fixed it this year, or did they have a similar approach, you thought?
Yeah, I think this year was a lot about projection, you know, and as Daniel Jeremiah said with us today, that, you know, this is going to be one that you better not have an opinion on, like, this year, right? Or maybe even the next year. I mean, the impact of this draft is probably more than likely going to be felt 3 years from now. So if you are in that camp of, oh my gosh, you didn't get Russell any help. Oh my gosh, he's in the prime of his career. Oh my gosh, you know, this offseason in totality of what they've done in the draft and in free agency and everything else sure does not feel like you have given Russell every tool. If you're in that camp, I think you've got some kerosene that you could throw on your fire. As Bill Barnwell wrote about, I think put them at 26th in his rankings of overall offseasons in the NFL. I think there's some fuel you could throw on that fire if you wanted to.
Kerosene.
Is that the wrong word? Yeah, lighter fuel.
No, you're absolutely right. There's all kinds of accelerants that you could use if you wanted to complain about that.
Tom,
situation.
Were you a pyro that growing up? Were you a fire guy?
I don't really want to admit to anything on the air.
Okay.
You know,
Tom, have you ever said anything
may
on
not
fire?
Have grown up yet.
Oh, okay. Just blink twice.
Maybe. I don't know.
You know what movie we watched the other day, Stacy, by the way? I don't know if you guys have seen it.
What's
you
that?
90s children, you, or 2000s. Have you guys seen Jerry Maguire? Have you watched Jerry Maguire lately? Jerry Maguire plays, man, through the decades. I was surprised. And you just said blink twice. You remember what they had to do, what Bob Sugar said to Jerry Maguire when he was hanging out with Kush? And Kush's dad on draft day. Do you remember what he said to do?
He said anything or something
movie.
Over the phone.
What, Stacy? Did you just say you've not seen Jerry Maguire?
Oh God! No.
Oh my gosh!
Yes. Okay. Yeah, she has not seen it.
Oh, you guys got like three downs or something. You got to get to. All right. So I got to run.
Hey, Brock.
He said, "Sniff."
Show me the money, baby.
He said,
"Show me the money."
Show me the money, but he also said, "Sniff if Maguire's in the room. Sniff for me. Don't blink twice. Sniff." So, yeah. So that was his cue. And Stacy, please go watch Jerry Maguire tonight.
I will.
Like, watch it tonight.
Okay.
Okay. You'll enjoy it.
Okay.
Sorry, Tom. I cut all you right. off about the whole pyro stuff.
That's okay. I was just going to say goodbye to you and thanks for coming on.
Oh, always a blast. Love you guys.
Oh, Tom doesn't mind that.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Brock.
The Brock and Salk podcast can be found at brockandsalkpodcast.com. Pretty simple there. Right now, we're in four down territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by MM Comfort Systems.
With Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
We live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
The dicey topic here. How are NFL players, coaches, and members of the front offices reacting to the potential of the new minority head coach slash GM rule?
Yeah, Tom, I reached out because we had this conversation and it came out over the weekend. So I was just really curious to kind of do my own little polling and talk to multiple players, multiple coaches and people in the front office. And I think that the majority of them are in favor of this new proposed rule. And the reality is that, yes, it might not be perfect. There might be ways to manipulate the rule, but it still presses the issue to try and make changes and to make things happen. And I think Stacy's, point on this was what rang through to a lot of these players was the fact that, look, I don't really care about the way that they get the opportunity. It's the fact that they get that opportunity and they have the chance to make the most of that opportunity is what is valued. But the overall sentiment is that this is a broken system. This is a broken rule in terms of the Rooney rule. And unfortunately, you don't have great representation in terms of minority coaches in a league, in this league. And it just goes to expose or show the hiring practices of the NFL. So that was really what I got out of it. I think more are in favor than the other point of view, simply because they are looking for more opportunities or wanting to see more opportunities.
Then why don't they just make the hires?
It's a great question. I think it goes to show.
You can say all day you're in favor of it until you make the hires. It's like, come on, you know?
Absolutely. But that's why I think it's important to look at the players and the coach's point of view rather than, the owner point of view, because clearly those are the guys that are struggling to make those changes in those hires.
True. Second down.
I'll be quick.
Bruce Irvin. What?
I said I'll be quick.
Oh, okay. Bruce Irvin met with the media today. What stood out to you?
What stood out to me was that he specifically wanted to be in Seattle, and I know that sounds very, very simple, easy, but I think it was kind of refreshing for a lot of Seahawks fans to hear someone say how grateful they were to be here, how happy they were. He told one story in particular about watching the Seahawks beat Philadelphia and then texting his friend and now teammate again, Bobby Wagner. The Seahawks were getting on the plane after the Philadelphia playoff game, and Bruce said, I'm changing one of the words here, dang, I wish I was on that plane with y'all. I thought it was just kind of nice to hear. If anyone wants to listen to it, we're going to have audio, if not later in our show, then I'm sure for Bob, Dave, and more later today. So stay tuned to 710 ESPN Seattle. But the video is also up already on the Seahawks website. So he already talks about what he thinks his role will be on defense, where he thinks he'll be playing, what he thinks of the young pass rush. So all of that stuff is also in there.
Third down. Does GM John Schneider ever go too far in looking at other options? Yes.
I would say that John Schneider, I don't believe he goes too far. I think he's doing his job. And I think the important factor in all of this is, are they communicating with the players as they're going through this process? And my perfect example of that is Josh Allen and these Patrick Mahomes conversations. I think Salk, when he brought it up, well, hey, John Schneider's doing his due diligence because he doesn't know where Russell Wilson's going to be. I think that's apt to be the situation. One where Russell Wilson always has said he's wanted to be here in Seattle, but has been willing to move on if the organization is not going to give him what he has earned, right? And through that process. So through his second contract with Seattle, they went and looked. There was rumors about Patrick Mahomes. There was rumors about Josh Allen. And I think the responses that you saw in this third contract negotiation was in retroactive to those rumors, right? And also the fact that we forget about this, that Russell Wilson had to put a deadline on this conversation because there was no conversation going on at that time. you know, for that two and a half week period. So I think Russell Wilson's intent has always been to want to stay in Seattle, but there's always been these rumors and these conversations that have happened because John Schneider and the organization have always been doing their due diligence. I think that sometimes, as long as that communication is strong, you avoid those situations.
Fourth down. Seahawks rookie jersey numbers were announced. We'll go through what they were later. What's that selection process like from your experience as a player?
It's actually really funny because the selection process is actually really uneventful. The GM, John Schneider, he selects the numbers for the players. He assigns the numbers. But the funny part from that point is you try to see guys that go and try and state their case as to wanting to get a new jersey number. Like, hey, I know this is what my number was assigned, but come on, I want something else, and I want this, or I want that. And the back and forth that will then go on between the GM or the equipment, that the main equipment guy, which for the Seahawks, that would be EK. And you just see a funny dynamic go on between all of those guys. And sometimes a player can win, sometimes they don't. But largely it has to do with, obviously, what is their contribution going to be to the team? Are you a backup, or are you a guy competing to be a starter or a starter? Those guys, the starters, have a little bit more way and say as to what their number will be. But oftentimes, guys, GMs and equipment managers aren't going to budge from the number that they assign you.
And sometimes even the guys who are going to be starters, the numbers that they wear in the preseason, they end up changing before the season. Like, I don't know why this is sticking out in my mind, but I remember Hakeem Nicks, my old wide receiver from the Giants. When he came into the league, he wore 18 during the preseason. And then after that, he switched to 88, and that was his number for the rest of his career. So I guess maybe not all of these are permanent, in case somebody's waiting for jersey number 58 or whatever. We'll go through what those jersey numbers are later on. One of them, I think, is telling. One of them, I think, is very telling as far as the expectation on that player. Remember, you now have radios in your homes. You have smart speakers. Tell your smart speaker to play 710 ESPN Seattle or 710 AM. The halftime show is next. Peyton Manning resurfaces in Seattle. What? We'll talk about it next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time for the halftime show.
The half is not over. There's 3 seconds on the clock.
Revisiting the biggest stories of today at the midpoint of the show.
The halftime show. It's not easy.
Now, here's Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
All right, the first thing we talked about at the top of the show, there was a couple of sound bites from Peter King of Monday Morning Quarterback fame, essentially retelling the story of how Peyton Manning was at one time involved in talks, or at least he was involved in a pursuit. The Seahawks were pursuing him, and he never really wanted to be here, as Peter King tells it. Cut number two. Go ahead, Curtis.
One of his really good friends was a guy named Brandon Stokely. He was a wide receiver, played with Peyton in Indianapolis for a while, and then he played in Denver. And so Brandon Stokely was living in Denver at the time, and basically Manning stayed with Stokely when he had visited the Broncos on this trip. And when he visited the Broncos on this trip, the Seattle Seahawks and Pete Carroll flew to the airport right near the Broncos facility, even though Manning said he really didn't want them to do that. And Manning didn't go meet Pete Carroll. You know, he ended up, Pete Carroll flew to Denver chasing Peyton Manning, and Manning never met with him. He got back on the plane and just flew back to Seattle.
So Pete Carroll flies down to Denver, even though Peyton warned him not to, and then had to turn around and fly back. By the way, that flight to and from Denver to Seattle is no joke. That can be seriously bumpy. Let's just say, though, for a second, that Peyton Manning had become a Seahawk, and his career had gone through to the end the same way it did in Denver. So it would have gone through 2015. The Seahawks would have been theoretically picking a quarterback hopefully, in 2016. Of these guys, which one would you have wanted? Jared Goff, Carson Wentz, Paxton Lynch, or Dak Prescott? Stacy?
Prescott.
Prescott? You know who I would have wanted.
Goodness. Jared Goff. Part of the Rams' of sexual offense. Jake.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm with Stacy on this one. I would pick Dak Prescott in this situation. I think he gives you the ability to be mobile. He throws the ball well, and I think overall his leadership qualities are very strong. So you're talking about someone, if you do appreciate Russell Wilson, I'm not saying Dak is on his level, but he brings a lot of the same qualities in terms of his play, but also I think his leadership style as well.
Yeah, I don't think that Goff would have been a good fit here as much as I love the guy.
No.
If it comes down to health, I'll go with you guys and choose Dak over Carson Wentz. I think when healthy, Wentz is a better quarterback. And I think the leadership stuff is all there for both of those guys. I think they're actually really close. But, yeah, the health, if that's the deal breaker, I'll go with Dak also. Next. Quentin Dunbar will appear in court this afternoon. His attorney says he'll plead not guilty to all charges. Now, based on what we've been hearing the last couple of times, we've heard from Michael Grieco, his attorney, and then we had Andy Slater on, the reporter who kind of unearthed the second half of that story last Friday. It sounds like if the police or if the prosecution doesn't have any witnesses that are willing to corroborate on the record that Quentin Dunbar did anything wrong, it sounds like he probably will have those charges being dismissed. I mean, we're not legal experts, but as of right now, my understanding is that anybody who was willing to finger him in the beginning has now changed their testimony. So how do you guys read that? What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, I very much see it the same way, in the sense that the way that this has turned, one, you have one aspect where all the victims have now, who originally said, you know, that Quentin Dunbar was a part of it, now they have written affidavits saying that he was not. So all of the witnesses that you said, they have now turned and are in favor of Dunbar's story. Secondly, if you think they're lying, well, in the court of opinion, the thing is that the attorney, all he has to do is deem those victims or witnesses not credible. And so, therefore, if they're not credible, then you can dismiss the case. So I think Quentin Dunbar right now, unless there is, you know, a quote-unquote smoking gun that links Quentin Dunbar to more than what he has said on his side of the story, I think it's positive for him getting these charges dismissed, which is shocking after what we heard when this story first came out. An unbelievable turn of events.
Yeah, I would assume those charges get dismissed. I mean, if what the police are relying on is witness statements, and then the witnesses, I think what the police would want to see is the witnesses speak to them and then recant those statements, assuming they're the same five people that were in the original police report. But I'd assume that if that's all you have to go on, then you don't really have a case. I'm sure they'll try to look into, I would assume, like, okay, was there legal possession of a firearm? Did they have a firearm? Like, I'm sure they'll try to do what they can to make sure that they didn't, like, do all of this, like, falsely investigate or anything. But what I wonder is whether the NFL will then do nothing, because they don't have to adhere to exactly what the Miramar Police Department does.
You know, what's interesting is DeAndre Baker, his attorney says he expects the case to be dismissed. He's pleading not guilty, too. I mean, someone in that room drew a firearm, didn't they? I mean, from what we heard, these witnesses are known criminals. You don't just invite the cops over to your house when you're having a party for no reason. Like, a gun, some kind of crime must have been committed there, whether it was by Baker or Dunbar or somebody else. But everybody's lawyer expects the charges to be dismissed, so I'd love to have a video of this whole thing, but we probably won't get one. Next. We talked about the Seahawks Foundation and who that includes right now. And, you know, for a while it's been Russell Wilson, it's been Bobby Wagner. And I guess you could say, I don't really count wide receivers. Maybe I'm just biased against them. I don't count those guys as part of a foundation. I know Lockett's been here a while. He's been great.
What?
Metcalf probably will.
So you wouldn't count Julio Jones
know.
Or Larry Fitzgerald as part of the Falcons and Cardinals foundation? Get out of here.
I would, but I think it's a mistake. I think that that might be part of the reason why those teams haven't won.
What?
The, what have the Cardinals won?
How do you feel about receiving tight ends? Would you count Gronkowski as part of the Patriots foundation back in the day?
Yeah, I would.
I think that you're looking at it from a Seattle point of view. And maybe you don't consider some of their wide receivers to be part of the foundation. And that you have to be an elite wide receiver to be part of the foundation. But there have certainly been those players for those franchises. Calvin Johnson.
I don't think you have to have. I don't think you have to have a Larry Fitzgerald or a Julio Jones to win a Super Bowl. I think you could build a Super Bowl team without any of those guys.
But if you have those guys, they are part of your foundation because that's part of what helps you get to the playoffs so consistently.
It's
but the
true.
Cardinals haven't gotten to the playoffs consistently.
That is very true.
Larry Fitzgerald has been
think
the
it's
most
a,
consistent part of their team.
It's true, but,
right, but
to Tom's point, they have not been able to consistently get to Super Bowls. And so I also think that the lack of offensive line and defensive line, not part of your foundation, I think is a little troublesome when you look at the Seahawks and the way that they want to play the game philosophically. So I think doing this overview of the roster, you know, from a foundational standpoint is very intriguing to see where they're at and where can they get better. That's for sure.
If I were to
look
back,
the Arizona Cardinals, yeah, I'm not done. I think the Arizona Cardinals could have been gotten to the playoffs more consistently were they not part of the NFC West. Like, yes, the last 4 years, not great. They have one season at 500, but then they're 13-3, 11-5, 10-6. Like, come on, those 3 years? They didn't get to the playoffs because at 10-6 in 2013, they were 3rd of 4 in the NFC West. I rest my case. That's been checked.
That's been checked? I don't think so. Since Larry Fitzgerald has been there, they made the playoffs four times. Four, Stacey.
Hall of Famer.
Oh, he definitely is. I love him. Like, he's my favorite wide receiver there is. But I think, investing in a wide receiver, too much money in him, putting too much money into him, I think is a mistake. All right, next we've got the timeline coming up. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, the number is 710-710, brought to you by Busy Hard Seltzer. Did LeBron James want to be a football player at some point? Like, what was going on there? We'll talk about that next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
This is The Timeline
with Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
Welcome back to Tom, Jake, and Stacey. Taking a second to read you the top stories you're going to see on your own timelines. What's trending in sports outside of Seattle? If you see any you want us to include on this segment or on tomorrow's segment, go ahead and tag us on Twitter at Stacey Rost, at JT Heaps 9, at Tom Wassel. Curtis, why don't you go ahead and get us started with this sound, cut number 4 from LeBron James, talking about how he almost started prepping for another sport in 2011.
You know what? To be honest, PR, it actually was. I had no idea how long the lockout was going to be. And myself and my trainer, Mike Mancias, we really started to actually train to be a football player when it came to like October and November. We started to run. We started to clock our times with the 40s. We started to add a little bit more in our bench presses and things of that nature. We started to add more sled into our agenda with our workouts. And, Mike kept talking about, you know, it'd be great to go down to Irvine, Texas. You know, it'd be great to go to Irvine, Texas. You know, Mike is, you know, he's from Texas.
Die-hard
Cowboy fans. You know, he's like, it'd be great to go down there to Dallas, you know, and suit it up for the Cowboys. How great that'd be.
I think
Here's
he means
the thing.
Irving.
I would have been very in favor of LeBron James as a player. The one question I have, and Jake, you might know more about, you will know more about this. When we watched the Last Dance documentary, all of us, one thing that we just kind of skimmed over but didn't talk about too much was Michael Jordan talking about how he had to train different muscles in his body differently trying to play in the minors getting ready for baseball versus basketball, and how when he came back, all of a sudden it was like he had to retrain his body, even though he's in perfect shape. Great physical shape. He's young. He's healthy. Just different muscles were training. We've heard Jonathan Martin, when he was with the Seahawks, tell, I believe, John Clayton at the time on 710 ESPN Seattle that he had to train his body to be like a track star during the combine. He can't be the only guy that thinks this. And then to make the transition from training your body to be as fast as it can to training your body to take on the workload of a D-end took quite a bit of a transition. So I have to wonder what the transition would be like for LeBron James, but man, at 6'8", however much he weighs, like you could be a tight end out there.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that he could have made that transition. And it really would have been interesting to see what position he wanted to play, because the crazy thing about LeBron James is he's so unbelievably athletic that he could have played receiver, he could have played tight end, he could have played defensive end if he really wanted to. And that's how tremendous of an athlete and how fluid of an athlete that LeBron really is. But I think when you talk about that transition from basketball, really having to run up and down the court, be in great cardio shape, jumping, leaping, all those things, and then, going to a sport like football where it really is about power, it's about physicality and explosion, there would be an interesting crossover and transition. And depending on what receiver or depending on what position LeBron wanted to play would depend on how much he would really have to bulk up. And so all those things would have been really fascinating to see how it would have played out. But I do think it's curious, guys, that LeBron, after The Last Dance, and after MJ, it was noted about the transition and how his trainer had to do this and that, that LeBron wanted to throw it out there and say, hey, I almost made that transition myself. Michael did it. I could have done something similar in terms of going to football. Maybe not baseball, but I could have done football. So I think the timing of it is a little funny too.
Would he have seen that as risky? I mean, think about the hits. Let's say he played, right? I mean, he were a receiver or tight end or whatever. If he took those kind of hits, I mean, are you risking your basketball career if you do that? I mean, he's built. It's not like he's, built like a stick, like he's Yao Ming or something. But,
yeah,
man,
to me,
that seems risky to me.
It is. I mean, to me, there are many reasons why the NFL Players Union doesn't have as much power as, for instance, the MLB Players Union, which is pretty much the most powerful union in sports. But one of them is the nature of the sports themselves. You have a shorter career in football. You just have less power as a player because you feel so, depending on who you are. Russell Wilson shouldn't feel disposable, but if you're like a bubble player kind of guy, maybe you're at a position, you're on special teams as a linebacker where you're taking hits all the time, or you're an offensive lineman, low on the totem pole. I'm worried at all times that if I get one injury, my career is done because someone's waiting to take my job.
What if LeBron James, was on a team that happened to get to the Super Bowl, and then he was responsible for totally bungling it, and he ended up having this awful moment? How would that affect his legacy? And then he never played again. It's like, yeah, I'm here to play football, then he screws it up. Huh?
But imagine if he was an instrumental, I would be shocked if this was the case, but imagine if he was an instrumental part of getting to the Super Bowl. Imagine if he lined up at tight end and had even 500 yards. If you'd never played football before, would be jaw dropping.
It's a great year.
Yeah, it would be a great year, and it would obviously elevate, no pun intended here, it would elevate his star, especially if he would go to somewhere like Dallas. Are you kidding me? I mean, talk about LeBron being a legend in basketball, going to one of the historic franchises in NFL history. I mean, that would have been unbelievable. It would have been an absolute circus. And I think there's a lot of football personnel, coaches, and even players that really believe that LeBron could make that transition, could have made that transition back in 2011 and been a very successful player. And that's what would have been really cool to see if he could do that. You know, with Michael Jordan, you always were skeptical of what he could do. But LeBron, I mean, you watch his high school highlights, you watch, you know, just little things that he's done here or there and just messing around with football, you know, flag football. He played a flag football game with Kevin Durant, and he is a fluid athlete.
Hey, Jake, when you were talking about the no pun intended before, when you said star, did you mean Dallas Stars, the hockey team, or the star on the Dallas Cowboys helmet?
The star on the Dallas Cowboys helmet.
Okay. You weren't talking hockey there. Good to know.
No, I wasn't.
All right.
Speaking
coming
of
up,
The Last Dance.
Oh,
I want to do this one last. We can save it. We'll save it. It'll be a tease.
We have 30 seconds on the clock here. That's
okay,
why I'm,
okay, okay.
I'm blowing past you here. My apologies. Is Pete Carroll too hopeful? Like this, if this soundbite, and I've not heard it yet, if this soundbite is what I think it is, it's the one soundbite I've been waiting for from Pete Carroll for like 10 years. We'll hear it next. 710 ESPN Seattle.